I am the product of Alcoholics Anonymous and a very loving higher power. I don't know much about anything except one thing. That when I came to AA, I was dead. Completely dead. I didn't know what my own name was. I came off the Bowery in New York into a group in Brooklyn. And I was taken there on the arms of a little Jew and his wife. And my old Jewish friend had told me that same day, if you come with me and Jean, and we'll carry you to AA, and you will have to drink no more, and you're going to be all right. And I believed them. I believed them because for the first time in my life, I had met someone who understood exactly how that I felt. So I came to AA with my little Jewish friend, and I came to AA and met a bunch of beautiful people. And I've been sober now for the past 26 years. And I am a walking, talking miracle. I make no bones about it. And I believe that any alcoholic that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous is a walking, talking miracle. And I'll do the best that I can here in a short time tonight to prove to you everything that I say. Everything that I say has happened to me. Everything that I have believed in has been taught to me by Alcoholics Anonymous people. Everything that I know, everything that I own, everything that I am or ever will be, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous and a very gentle and kind, loving higher power, God as I choose to call him. And how this could have come about is a most impossible situation. For me to stand here and talk to a bunch of people in British Columbia, except that if AA were not a God-given and God-inspired program. There is no fluke here. There is no happenstance here. I know from what I talk, because I have been allowed in the past 26 years to witness thousands and thousands of miracles. Walking, talking dead men that have come back to life and put their lives back together again. And I will tell you, I hope that I never move from this spot if I ever forget where my help came from. My help came from Bill Wilson, and Bill Wilson got his help from God as he understood him. And he has passed that legacy down to us now. And I am one of those people that were fortunate enough to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and partake of the generosity of a kind and gentle, loving higher power through Bill Wilson. I see it no other way. And if I told you that there was another way, then I would be a liar. I have seen it, I believe it, and I know it. I was born just like everybody else. There's been some doubt about that over the years, but some discussion. But I did have a mother and I did have a father. And I knew both of them quite well. You see, I was born into an alcoholic home. And I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and nobody knew anything about alcoholism. The only thing that we knew then was that my father drank too much. And the family was in dire straits because of his drinking. And when a kid is born into a home such as this, it's unpredictable as to what will happen. Because I was one of nine children. And the other eight children were fine, but here was Jack. He was the next to the last one. And there was something different about me. There's something completely different about me because I suffered more than my father suffered with his drinking. And as time marched on, it became very evident to me and to the rest of the family that there was something different about Jack. Something quite different. Jack couldn't go to school. Because if I went to school, I would stay at school and worry only about my father and my mother at home. And worry about the landlord coming for the rent. And worrying about my mother crying into her apron. And all these things affected me very greatly when I was a kid. And I learned how to hate very early in life.
because I hated those people that brought alcohol into the home. And make no mistake about it, my father was a good man. He was a good man. He was an alcoholic. And nobody knew what the disease of alcoholism was. So I grew up in this environment learning how to hate. I hated my father very early. Because each and every time that he lost a job and went out of drunk, he would come off and he'd be filled with remorse. And he would lock me back and forth in a chair and he would promise me there'd be no more drinking. And that he would get a job and that he would buy me a pair of skates. And he would do a lot of things and he lied to me. He didn't lie at that time, but when the time came for him to take another drink, he took it. That drunk would do the same thing all over again. So I lost my faith and my hope and my love for my father. And all I had in my heart was a tremendous love for my mother. And I wanted to take her out of that environment, buy a little house in New Jersey somewhere, and live with her and be happy. I wanted no trouble. I was a very quiet, shy, retiring kid. I loved to read. I didn't want to engage in sport. I had nothing whatever to do with football, or baseball, or basketball. And I grew up this way. And then one day, a miracle. A complete miracle. My brother and I were in a bedroom. And we were in a bedroom because it was raining. My father was drunk. And it was a Saturday morning. My brother came up from under the bed and he had a bottle of wine. And he told me what it is. Look, Jack, I found the bottle. Let's try a little bit. And I said, no, I don't need any of that. And he took the cork out and he tried it. And he said, Jack, you're making a mistake. It's nice. It's sweet. And I looked at him and I looked at the bottle and I did not have any inclination whatsoever to drink. I would repeat at this point that I hated booze. I hated people that drank. I hated my father when he drank. And yet here I was faced with a situation. And I looked at my brother and he looked so good he kept repeating how sweet that it was. And finally I reached out and I took a drink for the first time. And my brother kept saying, isn't it sweet? And I said, no. I said, it's a miracle. Because for the first time in my life now, with a drink of wine, just a short swallow out of a bottle, I lost all the fear and all the ungrounded and unfounded fear that I had lived with for 12 years. From the first moment that I was born, I was filled with what the medical people tell us now is the first and foremost manifestation of our disease. Ungrounded and unfounded fear. And when I took my first drink, that disappeared, and I felt good for the first time in my life. And I looked at my brother, and I said, Joe, have another. And he said, sure, and he had two. And I had the second one, and I asked him to have the third, and he said, no. If you drink too much of that, Jack, you're going to get sick. And I told him what I believed with all my heart. I said, you are absolutely stupid. I said, if the Lord made anything better than this, he must have kept it up there for himself. And I looked at the world, and I felt so good, and I asked my brother again and again to have another, and he wouldn't. And here now, some 40 years later, my brother lives in Lynbrook, Long Island. And I would say to any alcoholic, if you ever meet a Joe Brennan, especially in his home, don't drink with him. Because what he will do to you today is what he did to me 40 years ago. He will give you one drink, and if after a proper length of time, he will give you a second drink. And then the cork goes back in the bottle, and the bottle goes back in the closet. And you see, you have just lit the fire, and he is all finished. And for 40 years, that's what he's been doing, and he's still doing it today. And now we take his brother, same mother, same father, same environment, same home, same clothes, same shoes, same food. But what happened to me, I hope and I pray to God that doesn't happen to anyone sitting here tonight. I hope that with all my heart. Because for the next few years, I lived a life that I wouldn't miss on at all. I graduated from no school whatsoever. I have never even graduated from the grammar school. because the first moment that I took my drink in a bedroom with my brother at 12 years of age, I knew what I had to do. All I had to do to be able to live in this world was to take a little drink of anything at all containing alcohol. And I would relieve the tremendous tears and the terror that I felt in my heart, and I was capable of living just like everybody else. My mother and father had often told me, be like your brother, and I had tried. I tried to be like my brother, I couldn't, so I learned to hate him. But you see, when I was introduced to alcohol, age 12, just a quick trick, but I found the secret of living. And for the next years, I lived. But let me point out to you right here and now that the disease that I suffer from, chemical in nature, affects me in three areas of my life. It affects me mentally, in order that it enables me to do things that normally I would not be able to do. And it affects me physically, because it steals my health, it causes me to shake and tremble. It kills physical, I don't have to explain to anyone here. But it also affects me spiritually. And I would like to just dwell for one moment on what I believe is spirituality. A spiritual person is a person that is wanted and needed and loved. And the alcoholic, by his actions, due to the use and abuse of alcohol, becomes very unspiritual. He is not wanted. He is definitely not needed. And no one could love him. So this then was me at age 12. I had embarked on a career of drinking in order to live. I never liked alcohol. I never liked anything that contained alcohol in it until I found out that alcohol would enable me to live. I still looked on my father as a bum because I was not like him. I drank this stuff because that I needed it. And you would say, how does a 12-year-old drink? Well, it's very simple, especially if you're an Irish Catholic. If you're an Irish Catholic and you're an altar boy, you can drink pretty good. And I went to the church, and I was an altar boy. And I asked for the early mass, 6 o'clock. And nobody wanted the 6 o'clock mass, only an alcoholic. And I used to get at the 6 o'clock mass at 5:15. And I used to polish up all the things that I was supposed to, and polish off a little of the wine. And I tell you, they go first class in those sacristies, too. First class. Some of the best drinks I ever had came out of sacristies. But you see, I ran into problems even there. I would go along for a period of time with my 6 o'clock mass and be able to go to school. And I used to tell a nun, sister, why don't you sit down today and let me take over the class? One drink, I was a different person. But every once in a while, I would run into a priest that was an alcoholic, too. And he used to get there at 4:45. And that would be a bad day in my life, don't you see? I would go to school without my wine, and I would sit in the back of the room and shiver and shake and fear and hope that nobody would call on me. And if they did call on me, I would grunt answers at them. I was terribly ashamed. You see, this mirage grew up. It didn't last too long because, you know, I had a burning desire in my pocket, in my heart, to put a whole bunch of money in my pocket in order that I could do and undo the damage that my father did at home. And I'm not very proud of what I tell you. I'm not very proud at all. But at a very early age, I started to steal. And I graduated very rapidly. And I worked for a mob on the west side of New York for a good many years. And I hurt a lot of people. And I stole a lot of money. And every time that I stole money, I would think about my mother. I'd go home and try to give her some, and she wouldn't want it. I was thrown out of my home at 16. My mother came home and found me sitting at a table with a roll of stolen money, a bottle of whiskey, and a .38 revolver pointed at my father's head. I was a maniac when I drank. I was absolutely insane. And some of the things that I've done, I have to live with. And I say, thank God. Thank God. Each and every day, I thank God for AA program and its 12 steps that it contains. Because its 12 steps enable me, with proper application to my life, to be able to stand the stink of my garbage and turn it into something that might help someone else. So you see, while I do have my past, I never forget it. And I don't dwell on it, but it's there. I don't smell it anymore. I can stand it now because I have replaced my garbage with Alcoholics Anonymous. And you people sitting out there tonight so nice. I would like to say one thing right here. I get all choked up when I think. When I think that there are so many of us here in this one little room. One tiny little room and so many of us. And my mind goes back. My mind goes back to people that I saw that didn't come to the little room such as this. And I see kids in orphan asylums. And I see kids in shelters. And I see kids right where I used to live, age 11 to 17, doing 18 months of juvenile delinquency. I see lots of terror and I see lots of horror in alcoholism. I see nothing pretty. And then when I come into a room such as this and I see we eat so well, lovely tablecloths, I just simply like to remind us all, particularly me, just stop for 1 minute and think of what would happen if each of us tonight that are alcoholics here went out and got drunk. My mind cannot fathom, cannot tolerate such a thought, but it's a distinct possibility. There is no guarantee here except in each one's heart how sincere that he is and how much that he has turned his life over to Alcoholics Anonymous and the higher power. Can you think of all the children that would wake up tomorrow morning and be late for school? And can you think of all the bosses that would sit and wonder where Joe or Harry, they didn't come in today? And would you think of all the women sitting in kitchens with their world about their ears once more, wondering why did it happen? Everything was going so well. But you see, when they asked me to come to British Columbia, I said, sure, I have to come. Because there is one person here that will avoid such tragedy, I'm sure. My friend upstairs, he makes no mistakes. He does exactly what he wants to do. And I believe as I do believe. So I'm so grateful to be here and to talk to you people, especially that one. Because this then enables me to go home with a feeling of sense of security and love and usefulness. And how often I wanted to be useful, and now that I am, how good that it is. You see, the people that I hate, I cannot make any more amends to. I was a vicious animal when I drank. And there are people walking in this world that bear my scars. Because I would pick a gun in your belly, and I would not be satisfied with to take your money. I would more than likely bash your foot to bridge you the nose with a gun. Sometimes I have my memories at night, my nightmares. I had one this past week. And I saw an individual with his mouth hanging open. And I saw the blood coming out of the corner of his eyes, and I could hear the bones crush again. And I could hear, most of all, I could hear me laughing right in his face. What a horrible thing that alcohol is. I'm not proud. I am not the least bit proud. I tell you these things in order to enable you to put yourself in my position and evaluate your past. If you think that you can do it, you can. If I can be sober, and I can live for 26 years, and if I can return to my church, and I can become a useful citizen, then I say to you that anyone can do it. And of course you will say how, I will say only one way. Turn your life and will over to the care of God as you understand them. This is what that I did. You see, I ran my life according to my plan. And I stole much money, hurt many people. And I watched my mother be buried and I was not even able to get to the funeral. That same woman died of cancer. And the last word that she spoke to me, I sat in a room at home where I had to sneak because my father wouldn't let me in the house.
And I sat there in the middle of the night holding my stomach where I'd been stabbed in the course of a holdup. I had uncounted money in my pocket. And I sat there forcing to her holding my stomach together, bleeding like a stuck pig. And she said to me, "Jack, you don't look too good." And I said, "I'm all right, Mom. Don't worry about me." And when it began to get daylight and I figured that the heat was off, I could leave. She reached out for her pocketbook. And she said, "Here, please, Jack, take this dollar and stop somewhere and get something to eat. I don't think that you're eating too well." How I wish that I could go back and undo that. But I can't. I took her dollar and I patted her and I walked out. And I went back to the same thing that I had been doing. And the night that they called me in Greenwich Village in New York and told me that my mother was dead, I walked outside of the bar that I was in at 4 o'clock in the morning alone in this whole world. And I put my fist through the windshield of an automobile standing at the curb out of pure hatred. I hated everybody. I hated God with a passion you wouldn't believe. And I stuck my hand through a shatterproof glass window. It shattered. And if it had not been for the grace of God, I would never have survived that. Because two nurses going on a special sick call to a hospital across the street picked me up and saved my life. They carried me into the hospital bodily. And I came to the next morning, and there was two cops standing on either side of my bed. And my one arm was handcuffed to the bed. And I looked at my right arm that had gone through the window, and it was a mass of black with a big plastic bubble over it strapped to my chest. And one of the cops said, "If you so much as bat an eyeball, I'm going to beat you to death with this club." And I wondered what horrible thing I could have done now to deserve this. And I soon found out. I had gone berserk in the operating room. I threw cans of ether around the operating room. I punched doctors insensible that were trying to save my life. Two nuns that came and tried to talk to me, I also hit. I sat in the bed and I listened to these things about me and I said, "No, my God, it must be somebody else, it's not me." But it was me. Those are the things that alcohol caused me to do. I wound up with 203 stitches just in the lower part of my right hand. And they told me I would never be able to use my hand again. And they said, "It's a good thing, as nasty that you are." I used my hand after that. And I heard a lot more people too, because you see, I thought I was right. And when people tried to help me, I had been arrested over 125 times. I've done time in 2 state prisons in New York. And when people tried to help me, and many did, many fine people tried to help me, priests and ministers and social workers and doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists. And they all started their help with the same attitude. "All you have to do is stop drinking, and we'll help you. Do anything you want in this world, only stop drinking." And I used to say, "Yeah, I know that story backwards. I can't stop. I'm one of those people that have to drink or I'll die. I can't do a thing when I don't drink." And this is the way I believe, and this is the way that it was. So I ran many, many fine people away from me. And I sat with my friend, Boots. He gave me a drink, and I could do anything. But there was one strange phenomenon always occurred. You see, I would drink, and I would be a maniac, and I could do many, many nasty, desperate things. But the moment that I woke up in the morning, no matter where that it was, I was always back to being that 12-year-old scared kid. I used to sit on the end of a bed, look at the stolen money in my pocket, look at the bottle on the dresser, wonder where I had been, smell my gun to see had it been fired, and cry like a baby. Because I was doing things that I didn't want to do. And I was so ashamed of me that I would reach out for the bottle and I would say, "Get away, 12-year-old scared kid." Nobody wants a 12-year-old scared kid in a man's body. So I would take my morning drink, and then I'd be capable of going out the next night and doing exactly the same thing that was breaking me up so bad that morning. I lived a life such as this. I got married. I married a very gentle woman. A very quiet woman. She thought that my friends were really wonderful people. They spend so much money, Jack. And they go so many places. And she didn't know they were spending other people's money, of course. But she was a very naive woman. And she used to love to see the bright lights in New York, and we loved to show them to her. But she started to ask many questions. She started to ask me things like, Jack, when do you work? Well, I would say to her, why don't you just be quiet and be nice like a wife should be? And as long as you have money, why do you worry about me working? Then I would tell her I was on vacation. And after the vacation, I said, well, now I'm on sick leave. And she never knew exactly what that I did. And she asked me why I drink in the morning. I said, because I'm up all night. Morning to me is night to you. And this is the way that it went. But she asked too many questions. I had to leave because I didn't like it. I was not only ashamed of what I was doing, but I didn't want people to see me. I didn't want people to see me get up in the morning and reach under the bed and take a half a glass of water, a glass of whiskey. I knew that I was like my father. I knew that there was something wrong, but I was going to beat it. Well, I never beat it. I'm going to make a long story short here tonight, and I'm going to take you back just quickly. I came home one day and things were getting desperate. There was no money in the house. We were on welfare. And I would sit in a window, look out a window, and drink my whiskey and steal welfare checks. We had two children at this time, two little infants. Yeah, two little babies. One, I'm not sure. It's not important anyway, at least one. And I couldn't tolerate anybody near me. I couldn't tolerate anyone near me. My wife came in one day and she told me that I was not anything what I thought that I was, a hero, a smart guy. You know, she said, you're a drunken bum. And she said, I can prove it to you. And she gave me a book marked Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book. And I said, what is that all about? She said, that's what you are. And I said, you're crazy. And I said, those are a bunch of sick people, not me. And I threw the book out the window and I told her that she'd follow it if she kept annoying me. And the next thing you know, she told me something that I will never forget. She said, Jack, you're sick, and I'm going to help you. And I resented it immediately because help for me was what people were always doing to me all my life, snatching my liquor, snatching at my booze, trying to hurt me, taking away my friend. And I said, don't start with me now again, please. You're the only thing I have left in this world, but if you start too about my booze, leave it alone. She said, but Jack, my son there needs a father, and I need a husband. She said, we're not going to have it long because you will die. You're killing yourself. I'm going to help you whether you like it or not. One day I went to my favorite bar, and he wouldn't serve me. He told me my wife had been there. And he said, if I give you one drink, she promised me to burn my bar down. And he said, if you want a drink somewhere today, Jack, you go elsewhere. I went elsewhere, and she had been there before me. And I went in about a 10-mile radius. She had hit every delicatessen, grocery store, bar and grill, and speakeasy. And I went home. I was going to murder her. I was going to kill her. And I went in the house, and I announced my intentions. And she said, wait just 1 minute, Big Shot. What is it that you want, a drink? And I said, yeah. She said, well, I'll give you a drink. And she said, now, just come to New York with me. I'll give you a drink. So I just looked at her, and I needed a drink so bad, I said, okay. So I got on the subway for a drink. When I got off the subway, the experience was so bad, she gave me another one. And now she said, now we're going into that church. And I said, no. I said, that is a Protestant church, and I'm a Catholic. I don't go in there. And she said to me, you are a drunken bum, and it's all that you are. You haven't been to church in 20 years. It doesn't matter where that you go. You promised me to go, and you go. So I went in, and I sat in the back of the room. And I asked her what that it was, and she said, Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. They're going to help you. I said, good. You better start helping me quick, because I need a drink. And I sat there long enough for some jackass to get up here like I'm up here tonight. And he said only one thing that I hope. And I almost exploded. He stood up here very calmly, and he announced to everybody there, and that the only thing that you had to do was not take the first drink, and you wouldn't get drunk. And I said, I will kill him. I will kill him. I could visualize that ride that I had taken in the subway coming to New York. And now that some of you are telling me, don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk. Well, I knew that. I couldn't get the first drink when I was locked up. And I got sober. But I didn't like it. You see, and the thing that turned me loose, I got drunk. Because that was my way of living. Well, I broke up that meeting. I got out of there in one big hurry just before the cops arrived. And I told my wife that night, you ever take me to AA and I'll kill you. I don't want no part of it. I made a big, fat statement. I said, if I ever put my foot inside another AA meeting, as long as I live, I'll have to be dead before I do it. And you know something? That's just about the way it happened. I was so close to bed, it was not pretty close. Checking home one night, there were two cops in my apartment. I threw them out bodily. If there's any cops here tonight, remember, peace. Peace. I don't want no trouble with you. I am talking about the past now, see. I hated cops. I hated them with a passion because they were the cause of all my trouble. And to find two of them sitting in my apartment, that was terrible. And I asked them what they were doing there. They said, well, your wife called us because you almost killed her last night. And my wife showed me marks on her throat, and I said, no, I was not even here. That's how bad that I was. Well, anyway, I threw the cops out because the man told me to scare them. And I threw them out, and they didn't like it too good. And they got reinforcements. And they come back, and then they threw me out. And then for the next about a year, we were playing King of the Hill with my apartment, don't you say? I would go home, look for cops, they run into it, they would come and look for me while I was out, and we were having a ball. This one particular day started the worst part of my life. But when they got me outside the door, they put cuffs on me, don't you see? And I was on the sixth floor, and six flights of marble steps. And they said, hard guy, we're going to take you down, we're going to book you. And they grabbed me by the heels. And they dragged me down the stairs. And my head hit every marble step on the way down. And when we got down to the bottom, they said, well, now, how do you feel, hard guy? And I said, please take the cuffs off for just 5 minutes, and I will show you how that I feel. They took the cuffs off. That was one horrible mistake. Because I went at them people with a vengeance. And I don't blame them one little bit. But they beat me so bad. Because I would not be beaten. And I remember one cop with his foot in my throat begging me, please, don't get up no more. And I said, oh, yeah, I have to get up, don't you see? Because you can't do that to me. And I'm going to get up and I'm going to take you out with me when I go. And they begged me and they pleaded with me. And finally, at long last, they called the ambulance and they had a straitjacket put on me. And they put me in Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn. The mad ward. Flight deck. Top floor. Absolutely insane people. Well, I woke up the following morning in a straitjacket, lashed to a bed in a padded cell. And I want to tell you something. I didn't want to drink no more. Absolutely, I didn't want to drink no more. Because my head was one mass of stitches. My ear was so badly beaten on the inside, it blowed on the outside. My mouth was torn apart. My teeth were kicked up into the roof of my mouth and were nothing but stubs of teeth. My arm was broken. My ribs were broken. My both jaws were wired together. I had clots of blood in the back of my throat. I didn't dare breathe for fear I would choke to death. I couldn't see out of either eye. I was a mess. And I lay there in that bed, 12 years old and scared, and I said to myself, Jack, you can't drink no more. This is it. You've had it. And I made every vow that a human being could make. I'm going to drink no more. And I went out and I went home in a deep length of time. And I went home and my wife looked at me and she said, what are you going to do now? I said, don't know. I'm going to drink no more. And I sat in a corner, afraid to move, afraid to go out in the street, afraid to talk. And my brother came and my sister came and nobody understood me. And I sat 12 years old and scared. I couldn't sit no more. And finally I went out. I asked my wife for a dollar. I said, I can't live like this. It's impossible. I have to get a job. I have to do something. And she gave me a dollar very hesitatingly. And I went down the corner just to take one drink so my guts would stay in my belly when I got on the subway. And when I took that one drink, it was like somebody turned the key in my head. More the thought of a job went out the window. Everything that I thought was right came wrong. And I went looking for the cops that had beat on me. How stupid can we be? Or how smart can we be? I repeated that same episode 12 times. 12 times. Bellevue Hospital, Kings County Hospital, Central Islip State Hospital. Beaten to a pulp, lapped into a straitjacket, taken into a hospital, hopeless, helpless, insane. Let me tell you, normal people couldn't do it. You have to be an alcoholic in order to do those things. Once is enough for anybody, but the alcoholic seems to go on and on and on and on. First time I would come out of the hospital, two detectives caught me. Waited at the door, took me to a judge, very lovely judge. I knew him quite well, he was a decent man. The two detectives wouldn't let me get a drink, and I thought that was unusual. And when I got to the court, my wife was there. She had one baby in her arms and the other walking, toddling. And I knew something terrible was about to happen. And it did. Judge read me a piece of paper signed by three doctors. Jack Brennan is a homicidal maniac. Might like to turn me out overnight, not even know that he did it. This man cannot tell the difference between right and wrong. This man will never ever work another day in his life. It is impossible for him to live more than 5 years. And if he does by some chance live 5 years, he will spend the latter part of that 5 years in a mental institution because he is suffering from severe brain damage. It is highly recommended that this man be removed from his home for the protection of his family. And I looked at my wife, but I was 12 years old and I was scared. And I asked her, why do you do this to me? She said, I tell you why. Because my children have to have a chance to live. And they can't live with you. You're a maniac when you drink. I said, we have done everything in this world to help you and you didn't have help. So now get out of our lives and leave us alone. And let me raise my children that the judge has given me. And if you stick your dirty, filthy face back in my home where I'm raising my children, she said, I'll kill you myself. I'll take a knife and I'll stick it in your belly while you're sleeping, but you're not going to interrupt my children's lives. Get away from me. I hate the day that I saw you. She was a very naive, gentle woman that I married. And that's the way I had created. And then the judge told me, Jack, please, don't argue. Just go. And he had two cops put me on the subway over the turnstile, and they soon told me, don't come back to Brooklyn, Bama, we'll kill you too. We'll finish it. We've had you up to the eyeballs. We're not afraid of you no more, because you're nothing. You're absolutely nothing. And I went then, I went over to New York, full of big ideas. I was going to get a gun, and I was going to do this and that. No. No. Lies. How we delude ourselves. I couldn't get a gun. I didn't know which end the bullets came out anymore. I had no friends that were stupid enough to even bother to talk to me. When I arrived in New York, I didn't go to Mulberry Street, where I used to be the big shot, you know. No, I went to the other side of Canal Street, the Bowery, and I lived there for 2.5 years. In the winter and in the summer, and I had body lice, and I had hair down the back of my neck, And I was hit with cabs and buses, and I fell down subway stairs, and I slept in the rain, and I slept in the snow, and I prayed God every minute that I could remember. Every second that I could remember, I prayed God, my mother, my wife, my family, my brothers, and everybody that walked past me and had a pair of shoes on his feet, which I didn't. Hey, you don't know the meaning of the word. You don't know the meaning of the word. I was so full of hate that God kept me alive. Hate was the only thing that kept me alive because I didn't eat. And I sat and I mumbled to myself the terrible things that I would do one day to those that had hurt me. Well, you see, 38 years ago, A.A. was born. 30-some-odd years. And it was then that the higher power reached down into this mad world and gave Bill Wilson the secret for people like me to stay sober and live and learn how to live. What had happened back in 38 years ago was a helpless, hopeless, desperate alcoholic, helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic received the gift of understanding from a very loving higher power. Up until this time, for 3,000 years of recorded history, there was no help for the alcoholic anywhere in this world. No help whatsoever. We loused up doctors' offices. Nobody wanted us because they couldn't help us. And 3,000 years previous, the Chinese had described the disease of alcoholism. They said in the earliest recorded history, the man takes a drink, and then the drink takes the drink, and then the drink takes the man. A perfect description, 3,000 years old, of the disease of alcoholism. Well, I lay on the barrier, I knew none of this, but I knew only one thing. I had to die. And I praised God even for letting me live. I used to wake up in the morning and smell myself before I could see myself. And I would lay there and hope that I could close my eyes long enough to sleep a little longer. And maybe I'd wake up and it would all be a big bad dream, but it wasn't. And then one day I had hemorrhage in the stomach. I took a drink in the bar, and I went into the bathroom. Filthy, dirty bathroom you wouldn't put a dog in. And I had hemorrhage in the stomach with my crazy drink. And I fell down on the floor, and I hooked my chin on a filthy bowl. And I literally watched myself running down a toilet bowl. And it was at that time, and only at that time, that I looked at the bottle I had in my hand, and I said, that's not my friend. I've been wrong. And I threw a bottle over my shoulder, and I closed my eyes, and I prepared to die. But my friend upstairs, you see, who watches alcoholics. And every alcoholic in this world will come to that point, same as Bill Wilson did, a day of despair, when he will call out the same as Bill did, if there be a God, let him show himself now. Not tomorrow, not the next day. Now, I need you. Help me. That's what happened with Bill Wilson, and that's what happened with me many years later. Because I lay in that bowl and that toilet, I didn't die. My friend upstairs watched me. And pretty soon he started to put pictures into my head. And I could see pictures of my wife and my family. Good days and bad days. And I was delirious, no question. And I tried hard not to throw up anymore because I was so very weak. I couldn't move. And one picture came very clear. It was like I was up in that chandelier looking down and the heads of a lot of people moving about, milling about, drinking coffee and laughing all nice and clean. And I couldn't place what that it was. And then suddenly, like a tremendous revelation, it came to me. That was that AA meeting I had been at so many years before, where that brilliant man had said, don't take the first drink and you won't get drunk. And suddenly I started to cry, and I said, Jack, you damn fool. You had it, and you blew it. You threw it away. And I lay there, and I wept, and I cried, and I saw that picture, and I cursed me for the first time in my life. it was then that AA came to me. Because out of the whole mess, the chaos that was my life, one thing became very important. I wonder, could I possibly do it? I crawled out of that place on my hands and knees. I grabbed the stranger and I screamed at them and I begged them and I pleaded with them. Call AA for me. And some kind person called AA. And he told me, sit down here. Don't move because they're coming. And I was hardly hoping, daring that they would come. I thought maybe again I was hallucinating. Maybe they didn't say that at all. But I hung on to whatever I was sitting on to keep my mind and my body, and I waited. And AA came. Not a big Irish Catholic named Murphy, you know. No. Little Jewish fella named Sam Cohen. And I looked at him, and I learned a further lesson. Here I am, alone in this whole entire world. No wife, no home, no money, no health, no sight, nor couldn't speak. I couldn't do anything in this world. I was useless, absolutely, completely useless. And this little Jewish man stood in front of me, and he said, my name is Sam Cohn, and I'm here to help you. And I looked at him in amazement. And I said, are you sure that you can? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm sure. I know. And that was when he told his wife, the Queen Jean, keep quiet. Don't say that no more. Because she kept saying, oh, my God, oh, my God. And he said, he wasn't going to hurt you. He wouldn't bother you. Just leave him be. He's all right. And then finally she got close enough to me. And the two of them said, if you will just come with me, we will carry you to AA, and you don't have to drink no more, and you'll be all right. So now either this man had to be a nut, he had to be crazy, he had to be a damn fool, he had to be stupid in some way, or else one thing or other. He had to have a secret, something that he knew, and that nobody else knew. I'll leave it to you. Did he have a secret? And did he know what that he was talking about? I came into AA 26 years ago, as I've described. I was just so grateful and happy to be able to sit into a room where people would say to me, that's all right, kid. You'll be okay. I didn't want any speaking engagement. I didn't want a job. I didn't want shoes. I didn't want anything in this world, only one thing. Somebody to say they understood. And everybody I met did just that. So that I say to you that the key to this program is understanding. Understanding the other individual. Because I sat and I grew on understanding. You see, people told me, Jack, we need you. Please keep coming back. And I couldn't understand it. And my friend Sam Cohn, had he told me to go in the corner and cut my throat, I would have done it. I didn't argue with him. Because he was a man that knew, I knew that he loved me. So everything he told me, I believed. I believed with a very childlike faith because my mind was that of a child. I had been beaten so badly that I didn't know my own name or what year that it was. I didn't know who was the mayor or the president. I couldn't call anybody by their name. I knew nothing except one thing. At long, long last, I have found what I was searching for in the bottom of a bottle. Understanding. I would have settled for 3 months of sobriety and died happy. But my friend upstairs has different ideas. Because he gave me a sponsor. The out of this world. An AA man that was beautiful. I used to talk with Sam all the time. And when he told me that he needed me, I couldn't understand why. And I asked him one day, he said, oh, Jack, you're helping an awful lot of people. I said, how do I do that, Sam? He said, well, you are. When we get new people, we point you out to them. And we tell them if they keep drinking, they won't look like you. And he said, you're helping an awful lot of people. Please keep coming back. You see, now I was wanted.
And he said, you know something, we need you to wash the dishes, too. And we have very beautiful cups, you know, regular cups. And 2 weeks later, I started washing dishes. They went to paper cups because I broke them all. And everybody said to me, you're stupid. Nobody. They laughed. They said, oh, that's good, you can wash cups. And then one day, Sam said, Jack, we all love you. And I said, Sam, you know something? Where I come from, men don't love men, you know. And I said, you're not one of them funny people, are you? And he said, no, no. We love you because you're an alcoholic. I want you to think about that. I want you all to think about that. We love you because you're an alcoholic. We didn't say that we tolerate you because you're not, in spite of your being an alcoholic. He didn't say that we love you even though you are an alcoholic. No, no. That's the way I had lived. Everybody tolerated me in this world except till I came to AA. And then he loved me because I was an alcoholic. At last I had arrived. I had come somewhere where I was wanted, needed, and loved. And that was the beginning of my spiritual growth. Mentally, I got sober. Mentally, I got sober. Physically, I got sober. I stopped puking there for a few, 3 weeks. I was able to sit down in a chair quietly after a couple of 3 months. But I'm going to tell you something I will never, ever forget. Never in my life, as long as that I live, from where that I came and how that I got to where that I am today. I will never, ever forget my little Jewish friend, Sam Cohn, and my friend upstairs, the higher power. You see, I went to Sam one day, and I asked him, I said, Sam, I owe you my life. How can I pay you? He said, you're a stupid Irish pig. Coming from a little Jewish man, to me, that was a pretty hard word. I said, you know, there's something wrong. I don't know what that it is. I owe you my life, and you snarl at me. He said, I do, because you're stupid. I told you that it was not me, that it was the higher power. And he said, I gave to you what was given to me. And the person that gave it to me had it given to him. And if you carry it all the way back to the very place where Wilson is the higher power that gave it to him. So we all owe our higher power. No one owes anything. So if you want to say thank you to anyone, ungrateful Irish bum, say it to the higher power. And I said, don't speak to that man. He said, I know that. That is your trouble. And he said, you had better speak to him because you're not going to speak to me. And I said, you are nasty. He said, yeah, I am nasty, but I am right. And I said, oh, how do I do that when I curse him so bad? I hurt so many people. He said, talk to him just exactly the way you talk to me. Then he said, no, no. He said, you better clean it up a little bit first. So that night I went out, I didn't take the bus. I went on the sidewalk and walked home. And I talked to my friend upstairs. And I told him, I said, oh friend, that little Jewish guy in here said that you must love me because you sent him out after me. And I said, I gotta believe it. Because I'm sober and I got paid the shoes. And I'm doing real good. I got a little room. And I got a job washing dishes. And he says, I owe you. I gotta believe that. So I said, I'll tell you what I do. From here on, you tell me what to do, and I'll do it. No question. He's been doing that for me for the past 26 years. And you know something? Some days I say to him, I say, well, don't do it all right, but this time you're wrong. And when you get in trouble, don't you come to me, because it's your idea. And you know what? He's never wrong. Man, it looks like a jigsaw puzzle, and I dive in and do what I'm told to do, and it comes out beautiful. So I have stopped down. I just accept each day as it comes. And when I wake up in the morning, I have a little prayer that I say, and I like to share it with you. I have some copies here with me. I'll leave and put my feet on the floor and let the fog clear away just a little bit. And I send my little prayer. It says, I meet my God in the morning when my day is at its best, and his presence comes like sunrise, like a glory in my breast.
And all day long that presence lingers, and all day long he stays with me, and we sail in perfect calmness for a very troubled sea. So I think I know the secret, learned from many a troubled way. You must seek him in the morning if you want him throughout the day. When I have that little prayer, my mind is in the right direction for that day, and I go. And no matter what that happens, I know one thing. I am in the care of God, as I understand him, and nothing can happen to me. And that's the way that I live. I could stand here and I could tell you so many, many beautiful things, but I won't. It's late. I don't like to impose on people, but I will say one thing to you, as I repeat what I said when I first stood up here. I am a product of Alcoholics Anonymous and a very loving higher power, God, as I choose to call him. I will leave you and tell you that I have here a few copies of few very important pieces of paper. This one is AA and the higher power. And it describes the higher power and the alcoholic and their connection together. And it was written by a Jesuit, a very fine friend of mine. He died very unhappy because he was not an alcoholic. And I told him many times, all you have to do is drink a little more. But you see, beautiful it is. So I will leave you now, and I'll leave you with a little blessing I love so well. May the roads rise with you, and may the wind always be at your back, and may the sun gently warm your face, and may the rain softly fall on your fields. And until we meet again, may the good Lord hold us all in the hollow of his hand. Thank you, and God bless you.